Thank you all for coming. My name is Larry Michel. I'm the president of the Economic Policy Institute. I want to thank all our distinguished panelists for joining us today. Our topic is the very important topic about how to address the jobs crisis. And I think you all know the basic outline of the facts. We've already seen the fastest rise of unemployment in any period other than the Great Depression. We have ahead of us several years of persistently high unemployment. Unemployment is likely to even rise over the next year. We will continue to lose jobs for a number of months to come. And that even 2 years from now, it's projected that unemployment will be 8%. Now, 8% unemployment alone would be the highest unemployment since the early 1980s. So if anyone woke up a reasonable economist one morning and said unemployment's going to be 8%, they would say, we have to do something about that, and we can do something about that. And that's what we're here to talk about today, because when you have 10% unemployment over the next year, we're going to have 17, 18, 19% of underemployment on average. And we're going to have over a third of the workforce unemployed or underemployed at some point during the year, and that would be around 40% for workers of color. So this is an unacceptable outcome. There is no reason we can't do something to address getting, now that we are in a recovery, a very robust recovery with many, many millions more jobs, to start driving the unemployment rate down towards where it needs to be. Now, saying we need to do more about jobs, does that mean that somehow the recovery package has failed? In my view, not at all. Let's recall, in the 9 months that ended March this year, the 6 months at the end of last year and the first 3 months of this year, when no one could rightly say Mr. Obama was in charge of the economy, the stimulus package, recovery package, didn't even start having an effect until April. That was the fastest decline in the economy since we basically started keeping records by quarters in 1947. We had already lost 4.3% of employment, 6 million jobs, which right there was also the largest decline in employment since the Depression. Against that backdrop, I think it's a lot to ask that in 9 or 10 months, you turn what is catapulting into the abyss into bountiful shared prosperity. And the fact is that there was a bold, effective plan that was legislated very quickly, and that we'd EPI estimate is saving or creating 200 to 250,000 jobs a month, so that it already by the end of September had generated 1.1 to 1.5 million jobs. But that doesn't mean that we can declare victory. And we're here today to say, what are the next phases of economic policy that we need to pursue? I want to call your attention to a few things that were available on the way in. One was an urgent call for action to stem the U.S. job crisis. And for those on TV or watching us from afar, you can find that at the website epi.org. And there's also was a list of the distinguished panel who, because of they're so distinguished and have such long bios, I won't go through their bios. I'm going to actually just say who they are, and they will then be able to talk going from nearest to me to furthest away. So we have Wade Henderson from the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The empty chair is Janet Merguir from the National Council of La Raza, who will be here shortly. Third is Rich Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO and one of the founders of EPI back in 1986. And we're grateful to Rich for being here. Ben Jealous, president of the NAACP, and Deepak Bhargava from the Center for Community Change, the executive director. And so without further ado, we'll start with Wade, and watch out for the plant.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks, Larry. It was a very gracious introduction. And thanks for setting the stage, really, for our discussion this morning. I am Wade Henderson. I'm president of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The Leadership Conference is the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition. Today, core elements of the civil rights and progressive communities have come together to address what is unquestionably a national crisis that's affecting us all. Make no mistake, this is the civil rights issue of the moment. Unless we resolve our national job crisis, all of our other priorities, from reforming health care and fixing our broken immigration system, to stemming home foreclosures and expanding economic opportunity for all Americans, all are in real jeopardy. For this reason, there is no greater priority for the civil rights community and the Leadership Conference than ensuring that Americans can get back to work with good jobs that they and their families can depend on to build better lives. Economic security has always been at the core of the civil rights movement. Indeed, Americans' civil rights cannot be divorced from issues of economic justice and job security. It is no accident that one of the founders of the Leadership Conference in 1950 was A. Philip Randolph, the legendary founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and a leader of the March on Washington. Randolph's leadership ensured that the civil rights movement has always understood that there can be no equal opportunity for African Americans, for Latinos, for women, and for other racial and ethnic minorities without economic justice and a stable job that provides a living wage. The current job crisis is as severe as any our country has seen in nearly a century, weighing down our economy, undermining the stability of families and communities, and weakening our national security. Until we solve the job crisis, we will continue to have high foreclosure rates and hollowed out neighborhoods. Until we solve the job crisis, parents will spend more time trying to keep roofs over their heads and food on their table. And I remind you of the USDA's report issued yesterday on the tremendous spike in hunger in the country because of job loss. We're going to be dealing with that issue rather than saving money for children's college education. And until we solve the job crisis, our influence as a nation will suffer, even as we seek to repair our standing in the world and support our troops fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. Obviously, the significance of this crisis cannot be understated, particularly for the communities that we work with most closely. While the U.S. official unemployment rate is about 10.2%, for African Americans, the unemployment rate is almost 15.5%. For Latinos, almost 13%. And although the unemployment rate for Asian Americans is below the national average, even their participation in the workforce has dropped at a faster rate than other groups. By and large, these are people who have little, if anything, to sustain them during a prolonged jobless recovery and who can scarcely afford to fall further down the economic ladder. When large portions of our population fall behind, our entire nation suffers. Our future prospects are diminished, and the promise of America being the land of equal opportunity becomes harder to fulfill. Now, given that, the first thing we must do is to ensure that Congress increases and extends unemployment insurance, food stamps, and COBRA, ensuring that our nation's most vulnerable people survive this crisis so that they can take advantage of new jobs when they are created is not just good economic sense, it's a moral imperative. We are pressing to ensure that Congress does just that. Now, beyond that, we believe it's imperative for the public and private sector to work together with laser-like focus on job creation. Our country and the people who suffer today cannot wait for conditions to improve on their own. The challenges we face are extraordinary, and they require both bold and targeted responses. Now, I look forward to working with my colleagues on this panel as we amplify the concerns of everyday Americans looking to get back to work and working to achieve the American dream. Thanks very much. Rich Trupka, president of the AFL-CIO. Hey, hey.
After you. Thank you. Thanks, Wayne. And thanks, Larry. And thanks, EPI, for all you're doing. And thank each one of you for being here today. Now, I'd like to start by telling you a story about a young woman who came to an event that we held in northeastern Ohio about 2 months ago. Her name's Lacey, and she's not quite 20 years old yet. And Lacey wanted to become a teacher. But when her father was laid off from a plant that was shutting down, her parents had to struggle to just hold on to their home. So instead of going to college, she had to find a job. And she said that she felt really lucky to get one working in a school cafeteria. But 6 months later, the school budget was a wreck and she was laid off too. And she and her father took turns checking the internet for job postings every morning. So after 3 months, she was able to find a part-time job working afternoons at a fast food restaurant. And again, she said she felt lucky to have that job, even though she brought home about half of what she did from the school cafeteria. Her father still doesn't have a job. He's one of a third of all the jobless who have been unemployed long term. Lacey lives at home with her parents and told me that she just prays that they're able to keep their house. See, she has more friends right now who are unemployed than friends with jobs. And here's what she said. She said, "I wanted to be a teacher to help children get the education that they need to get ahead. But now I feel like I'm just going backward myself. I'm really scared for kids my age. We want to work. We need jobs." Lacey's right. It's scary. It's scary to see so many families in trouble, to see a generation of bright young people who may never reach their potential and whose lifetime's earnings will be stunted because of this economy. Now, I want to be clear as well that the recovery package passed earlier this year has created or saved more than a million jobs. And quite frankly, it pulled our economy back from the brink of what I'm convinced would have been a depression. It was critical, and it was an important step. But over a period when we needed to create 2 million jobs just to keep up with population growth, we've lost more than 8 million jobs. That's more than 10 million jobs in the hole since the recession began in 2007. And unfortunately, we haven't hit bottom yet. That's why the AFL-CIO is working with our friends, our colleagues, our associates, and we're putting forward a five-point plan to create and save at least 2 million jobs over the next year. Now, I want to say this. Of course, while we're working on creating 2 million jobs right now, we can't lose sight of the big picture either. We know that we also need to keep working on deeper reform measures to ensure that we're rebuilding our economy on a solid foundation. We need the Employee Free Choice Act to guarantee workers the freedom to choose a union. We need financial reform to rein in the excesses of Wall Street. And we need to fix the flawed trade policies to make America competitive again and reduce our enormous trade deficit. But here's the five-point jobs plan that we believe has some great promise. First, we have to extend unemployment benefits, food assistance, and health care for the unemployed. Without congressional action, the federal supplemental program will expire at the end of this year. And without those benefits, the downward spiral will accelerate as families fall into bankruptcy, lose their homes, and lose their health care. These benefits are critical not only to the unemployed, but to maintain personal spending that will save and create jobs throughout the economy. Second, we need to put America to work on our broken infrastructure. We have a backlog of at least $3 trillion of pressing needs in transportation, crumbling schools, and other infrastructure. $10 billion in funding for overdue repairs for schools was cut at the last moment from this year's recovery package. We think that's a crime and it needs to be restored. Because every dollar spent on infrastructure employs workers all down the supply chain in construction, manufacturing, design, and engineering. And we need to be sure those dollars create U.S. jobs and develop badly needed U.S. industrial capacity. And along those lines, we need to invest in good green jobs, green technology, energy efficient retrofits to public buildings and the smart power grid. Third, we have to boost aid to state and local governments to maintain vital services and prevent more layoffs. State and local governments and school districts are experiencing the worst fiscal crisis in decades. We have state budget shortfalls this year alone of $178 billion. And next year will be worse, and the four-year estimate is nearly $600 billion. This is happening right as we need those vital services more than ever. Without additional funding, our public safety, our health needs, and our children's educations will suffer. So the right thing and the smart thing is to take actions to save services, to save jobs, and to stop the hemorrhaging from choking off economic recovery. Fourth, we should directly create jobs that put people to work in our communities meeting pressing needs. Now, these should not be and cannot be replacements for existing public jobs. They have to pay competitive wages, and they should target distressed communities. And fifth, we need the administration to put TARP funds to work for Main Street. This is something that we can do right now, and it would make a critical difference. You see, the bank bailout was necessary, but it helped Wall Street restore profits when it should have been helping Main Street create jobs. Banks aren't lending to small business. So we should establish a TARP fund to lend TARP money directly to small and medium-sized businesses at commercial rates, managed by the community banks that were left out of the Wall Street bailout, with banks taking first dollar risks. If small business can get credit, they'll create jobs, and we need those jobs now. See, millions of families like Lacey's aren't seeing relief yet. The hurt is deep, and it runs the risk of lasting a generation. It's scarred children. It's hitting people of all ages and races and occupations living in all kinds of communities, whether they're rural, urban, or suburban. And the damage, as Wade said, to African American and Hispanic workers has been especially devastating. Doing nothing is not an option. If we don't act, everything will be worse, and that includes our federal budget deficit. That's why those of us here today have joined together to say this is not tolerable. We can put America back to work. The AFL-CIO will be taking the five-point jobs program I've outlined to the White House and to Congress, and we'll be there every day. Working with the other groups here today and with business leaders and elected officials at every level, mobilizing and helping the White House and Congress get this job done. Where there's an obstruction, we'll expose it and push through it. And where there's leadership, we'll do everything that we can to help it succeed. America needs jobs, and we need those jobs now. Thank you.
Am I next? Okay. Good job. Good morning. So each week I travel to about four or five cities around the country. And in the last couple of weeks I've been to Dayton, Ohio, where I was there to talk about school quality. And all folks wanted to talk about the fact was that the a tech firm was leaving, and a dog food, tech company was leaving, and a dog food company was leaving, and a third company from an entirely different sector of the economy yet was leaving too. And then I was up to the city of Elkhart, where the president has been 4 times because the unemployment rate is so high. And they appreciate the attention, and they understand that the president is fighting for them, but they wish Congress was fighting for them too. Across this country, jobs, the lack of jobs, the loss of companies, the further deindustrialization of local economies is story one. And yet, the headlines nationally seem to always be talking about something else. We have a crisis in the black community because unemployment is 16%, 15.5, we can quibble. Sounds we just round up, 16%. Teen unemployment rate is much higher. And the danger in looking at those rates is the nation saying, well, that's just a black issue, that's just a people of color issue, that's something that the rest of us are somehow protected from. Almost 4 years ago, we were calling for a moratorium on housing foreclosures. And folks said, oh, well, that's really sad what's happening in the black community. Went on about their business. And it just about brought down the world economy. Black people, people of color in this country, are the canaries in the great American coal mine. What we get tends to hit everybody just a bit later. We have to be serious in this country about job creation. We have to understand that really the groups that stand up here today aren't separate movements coming together. It's one movement. It's one American human rights movement saying enough is enough. We have men and women dying protecting the interests of this country overseas. They need to know that when they've done their tour of duty, when they've fulfilled their time in the armed services, they can come home and find a job. Men and women should re-up in the military because they want to be part of the military, not because they're afraid of being homeless. Increasingly, when I talk to young service people at our branch functions, I travel around the country, they say that they're preparing to re-up because there's no job for them. We have to understand that what people in the cities I travel to each week want is something discrete. They don't want to hear a conversation about an indirect path to creating jobs. They want to hear that the president, that the Congress is committed to creating jobs, period, that's job one. But that's job one. The issues with regard to TARP are real. I spent a lot of time, and I'll be on the phone with some small bankers this afternoon. They understand that you know, the federal government is attempting to buy the toxic assets of the big banks, the major banks, the corporate banks, and that they've been sort of pushing off and saying, oh, well, you aren't offering us enough money for our toxic assets. Meanwhile, small banks, banks that support small businesses and local communities, can't get a dollar on the $100 for their toxic assets. The federal government needs to look at every transaction going forward with regards to job creation. We have an opportunity in this country right now to move beyond saving, you know, simply getting back to where we were 2 years ago. The structural investments in this economy have been profound, and they've, as my colleagues have pointed out, helped save jobs. But we at the same time have to be not just focused on bailing out Main Street, we have to focus on fixing Back Street. It is not enough if we just simply get back to a place where there's 9% unemployment in the black community. It's not enough if we just get back to a place where there's 22 or 25% teen unemployment in the black community. We have to be willing to look at our country as a whole and the adjustments that we're making and actually see the country as a whole. Part of why we're in the problem that we are in right now is we've chosen to see our country as a bunch of separate places and act like what happens in one room is not connected to what's going on in the next. At the NAACP, as part of our push to not just bail out Main Street, but to fix Back Street, we've begun engaging corporations across this country to reduce their unnecessary barriers to employment for formerly incarcerated people. We have 650,000 people coming out of prison every year. We have 9 million people coming out of jail every year. And those people are structurally locked out. You might ask, why would you do this now? Well, we know that if we don't deal with that issue, that the rest of the economy doesn't get better in our communities. Right now in this country, as it's been for several years, it is harder for a black man with no criminal record to find a job than a white man with a criminal record. It's harder for a black man with no criminal record to find a job than a white man with a criminal record. So when you're a black man with a criminal record, basically what that says is that you have no job opportunities. You have no job opportunities. If we don't deal with the various types of structural inequality and discrimination in our economy, even while we're trying to create jobs and save jobs, we continue to lock hundreds of thousands of families into poverty, into foreclosure, and force them into homelessness. So we're here to say that Congress needs to do the right thing. The right thing is to continue to fight discrimination. But job one is job creation. And everything that we talk about has to be talked about in terms of job creation. Again, the families that I meet with every week are tired of hearing about sort of, we're going to do this and this will lead to that, and then eventually 2 years from now you'll have a job. Because the reality is that in that time, they are likely to be homeless. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Larry, at EPI, and the colleagues on my panel here for convening this critical conversation. NCLR is joining our friends here today to shine a spotlight on the unemployment crisis that is hitting minority communities especially hard. Ben mentioned that he's been on the road. I was just in Omaha, Nebraska, and was hearing stories of how difficult it is for so many to be able to find employment or keep their jobs. Last week, when the national unemployment rate broke 10%, the media jumped and President Obama announced the Job Summit. The truth is, as for the African-American community, the Latinos, for Latinos, unemployment passed 10% 8 months ago. A full 54% of Latinos report that someone in their household has been personally affected by the recession. It's over half. And EPI reports that Latinos have the highest rate of underemployment, which counts workers who have to take part-time employment because they can't find a full-time job. What's perhaps even more concerning is that fewer than 30% of Latinos report seeing any direct benefits of federal recovery efforts in their communities. This includes jobs saved or created in the public and private sector or new loans for small businesses. So the help may be out there, but it's not reaching our families. This should come as a wake-up call to policymakers and the administration that the federal government needs to respond in a bold way, and fairness needs to be at the center of any job creation initiative. The Recovery Act was bold and necessary, but if there's one thing we've learned from this reception, it's that a rising tide doesn't necessarily lift all boats. We need specific strategies to reach the hardest hit communities. Otherwise, we risk widening disparities between minority and non-minority workers and families. NCLR supports a new, large-scale, direct job creation program that reaches into communities with real opportunity for workers. Essential components of a job creation package include targeting workers with low income, low educational levels, and those not currently receiving unemployment insurance. Include community-based organizations as employers, a critical piece of the formula for recovery. Invest in skills, training, and education to prepare workers today for the jobs of tomorrow. The details of this proposal are in a memo we brought today, and you all had a chance to pick it up on your way in. I commend it to you, as we've done our own studies and research and have made recommendations which we think will help hit those hardest communities, including our Latino community. So I want to underscore the importance of this conversation and the importance of creating jobs in communities of color. We look forward to being part of the broader discussion, but we certainly want to encourage the need for a bold response from policymakers that targets the hardest hit communities with job creation strategies. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Deepak Bhargava with the Center for Community Change, and I'm very pleased to join my colleagues and also want to extend my thanks to EPI for organizing this very important and timely forum. The Great Recession that we're now experiencing is an unfolding social catastrophe for America's families, particularly for low-income communities and communities of color that confronted deep economic problems even before the current crisis began. We face an extended period of unacceptably high unemployment, while our system of programs to help our people weather this storm is totally inadequate to the scale of the crisis we face. The severity of the crisis is being amplified by cutbacks in state and local funding as a result of the recession's impact on tax revenue. To respond to the crisis and to meet the needs of our people and our communities, a high priority should be placed on developing and quickly implementing a new federally funded jobs program to put millions of our people to work over the next several years. In both the 1930s and the 1970s, we responded to extraordinary hardship by adding a jobs program to the array of programs and services designed to help our people and to help pull the economy out of recession. We need to do so again. There are people who need work, and there is much work to be done. The program we envision would provide work to the jobless and meet needs in our communities, and by helping people meet their everyday needs would boost demand and help speed our economic recovery. A new jobs program could be run by local elected officials who are closest to our communities and best understand their needs, and they could collaborate with community organizations, labor unions, and other leaders to identify the projects that would be most beneficial in the local context. There are many innovative ideas being generated at the local level on how to improve communities and strengthen local economies that could be turbocharged with timely federal support. A national jobs program can unleash the creativity and collaborative spirit in communities throughout the country. Some of the new projects that newly employed people might undertake include painting and repairing schools, community centers, and libraries, cleaning up abandoned and vacant properties to alleviate blight in distressed and foreclosure-affected neighborhoods, expanding emergency food programs to reduce hunger and promote family stability, augmenting staffing and Head Start childcare and other early childhood education programs to promote school readiness and early literacy, and renovating and enhancing maintenance of parks, playgrounds, and other public spaces. The program we envision would place special emphasis on delivering job opportunities and needed services to low-income communities and communities of color that are now suffering depression-level unemployment and distress. Under this program, jobs could be created in the public sector, the nonprofit sector, or in small business. And we think it's critical that there be strong non-displacement provisions and that this kind of federally funded jobs program be accompanied by a strong dose of state fiscal relief to make sure that we are actually creating net new jobs rather than substituting jobs. If we act quickly, a jobs program like this could put hundreds of thousands of people to work during 2010 and would continue to provide job opportunities for several years as our economy recovers. This is a cheap date. Every 1 million jobs that we create would cost between $35 and $40 billion and result in dramatic effects in terms of well-being for families and children and communities and leave lasting benefits in infrastructure, education, and health that will pay dividends for years to come. The time to act is now, and I really appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you all for addressing the issue. I just want to reiterate that all the different things that people are mentioning, all the different policies that are being discussed about, really have several components. They are doing things that are important to do, whether you're protecting public services at the state and local level. That's an important thing to do. But when we do that, that also not only preserves the jobs of those people who work for the governments providing those services, it also helps jobs in the many private sector firms that actually deliver public services. Think of nursing homes, think of hospitals, think of contractors. And by keeping all those people employed, that is actually only half the jobs that get generated, because when they're employed, spending their wages, it actually pretty much doubles the job impact. Economists call this respending. Just think about it. Keeping people employed is good for other people. You know, when we create direct public service jobs, as was discussed by many panelists, when those people are employed, they are outspending. They are serving the economy. When we provide relief to the unemployed, if we renew the unemployment insurance program for next year, that alone could generate over 900,000 jobs, just by having many people who have low incomes, or especially temporarily low incomes. These people don't save their money. They're not paying down their debt. They are out there spending, creating jobs throughout the economy. So the things we're talking about are things that are going to create millions of jobs within the next year, and do well doing it.